Welcome to Season 2 of Forged in Fire, where we explore LGBTQ+ leadership with guests from all over the world. You'll hear as they share how they navigated their journey through crucible experiences to develop into amazing leaders. Forged in Fire is hosted by Colonel Bree Fram and Dr. Liz Cavallaro.
Hi, I'm Bree Fram, an astronautical engineer in the U.S. Space Force. I'm passionate about building the leaders of tomorrow and learning about what the LGBTQ+ leaders of today can teach us.
And I'm Dr. Liz Cavallaro. I'm an adult development scholar and associate professor at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also an experienced researcher, interviewer, leader development practitioner, and professional executive coach. Please join us as we discover the inspiring stories of how LGBTQ+ leaders are forged.
Welcome to another episode of Forged in Fire. Today, we are honored to be joined by Eric Fanning. Eric is president and CEO of the Aerospace Industries Association, where he develops strategic priorities and works with member company CEOs to advocate for policies and investment that bolsters innovative capacity and spurs economic growth. He joined AIA after serving as the 22nd Secretary of the Army, where, as the first openly gay secretary of a military service, he provided leadership and oversight to the largest branch of service. He's the only person to have held senior appointments in all three military departments and the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Prior to his roles at the Pentagon and AIA, he worked on the staff of the House Armed Services Committee and as Senior Vice President of Strategic Development for Business Executives for National Security. He was also the Deputy Director of the Commission on the Prevention of Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism, and was Associate Director of Political Affairs at the White House. He's been appointed to a number of bipartisan and nonpartisan boards and commissions, holds a bachelor's degree in history from Dartmouth, and has numerous defense civilian service awards. Secretary Fanning, President Fanning, I mean, there's so many titles we could give to you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, and Eric is just fine.
Eric, to kick off, we're so excited to have you as our guest because you have been queer in an impressive career. And over the course of this interview, we're going to ask about how you've developed and deployed your identity and your leadership skills over that time. But I want to start off kind of where you are now and talk about the fact that you've served in both public service and in industry and in national security in a number of different roles. How does it fit your leadership today to be working with industry and to have served in these different capacities, often which are considered very stereotypically masculine and may not be friendly to LGBTQ folks? What is it like serving now today as a queer leader?
Well, I've been lucky. I think someone pointed out to me very early on that if it weren't for the fact that I was gay, I wouldn't have anything about me that was minority or disadvantaged in any way whatsoever. You know, the flip side of that is I have all the benefit of privilege too. But I do think that being gay is a big part of the kind of leader I am and the kind of person I am, and how it manifested itself as a part of my career. The job now is, you know, another form of diversity, really. I've spent most of my life in national security on the government side or the nonprofit side, and this just gives me a different perspective to bring to my work.
Thank you for that. You highlighted something else that we were really curious to ask about, which is how much this has been a big part of how you have led and informed the way that you've approached these roles. You'd said a couple of years ago in an interview that you wouldn't be who you are if you didn't have that single element of you that is, in fact, minority or an underserved community. And you said that helped forge who you are as a person. And if you weren't gay, you wouldn't have that. So you're glad that you've had that. Why is it that you're glad about that? And how has that forged you as a person and a leader?
Well, a number of ways. I do think that being part of a minority community or disadvantaged community, a disenfranchised community, what have you, does make you more empathetic. It raises on your priority list helping others who might be facing barriers that have nothing to do with their ability to do whatever it is that they want to do. Because early in my career, I started on the Hill in the House Armed Services Committee. I was working for the committee chair who became Bill Clinton's first defense secretary, which is how I ended up in the Pentagon. I wasn't out yet. And we were creating Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And you know, there were a number of things about that. One is I learned the value of there being multiple voices in the room to provide different perspectives, because that was a very, very, very long time ago, dating myself. But I don't think that the senior generals and admirals and others in the room knowing I was gay would necessarily change their mind, but it would have at a minimum, I think, changed how they talked about it and the tone of the debate, the tenor of the debate. But it also ended up, and I did come out shortly thereafter, but I didn't see anybody like myself in that building. I thought I was the only gay in the village, which is mathematically ridiculous to think about. There's 25,000 people in that building, but it was of a certain culture. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell didn't apply to me as a civilian, but it certainly drove the culture of the Department of Defense, of the military. And not being able to see a path for somebody like me caused me to leave. I left government altogether. I left Washington entirely and took a different path. I missed it and I found my way back. And I think it did make me a better, more inclusive, empathetic leader. But it also worked out my advantages in many other ways, just in terms of realizing the importance of, again, having those different perspectives on a team.
So you mentioned you're coming out to others at that time, but a big thing we've found with queer leaders is a lot of that leadership development comes in coming out to yourself. When did that occur, and what did that look like for you when you had that either realization or those thoughts, you know, this is who I am, and then realizing, oh my goodness, I might actually have to hide this for some reason? How did that influence your early leadership development?
Well, I honestly don't remember when I first had thoughts that there was something different about me than other people around me. You know, that's a very early memory that you have to kind of wrestle with and build over time. You know, I come from a military family. I have two uncles that are West Point grads and career Army, another uncle who was served 20 years in the Air Force. Before doing things he couldn't talk about outside the Air Force. And so at an early point, thinking about military service or a military academy, I couldn't figure out a way to square this fact about myself that I knew I was going to have to deal with at some point. I didn't know when, but I knew I would, and military service. And so it impacted decisions I was making about my career very early on. And then when I got to a point where I thought, I want to deal with this now and it will conflict with where I'm working in the career path I'm on, I wasn't going to let the career get in the way of dealing with the personal things that I thought were more important and issues of personal integrity and just my own journey in that regard, which is why I left the Pentagon.
How has that path that you've spoken about as being something that sort of wrote itself very early on and even leaving DC for a period, right? Finding your way back, clearly being called to that service. The presence of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in terms of the culture that you mentioned, as well as your work as it related to it, how has that interacted with your path in terms of your own version, if you will, of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? What has that taught you about how you show up in the world, how others show up? I know you've spoken about how even recently you'll have folks ask you about coming out, both young people and older folks who have been around a while and are still on that journey and are perhaps not as far along. So how has that informed how you've led in those circumstances?
Well, so, you know, I came back to Washington. I was here during the George W. Bush administration, went back in the Obama administration. And I think being gay actually was a part of, you know, I had a reputation. I knew a lot of people. I'd worked in Washington in and out of government. And we had a president who wanted to try and expand the pool of people who could serve in appointed positions. And so I think that was part of what led me back to the Pentagon in the Obama administration. It was, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell still existed. And here I am going back into a building that discriminates outwardly against people in uniform, but sort of culturally against others as well. Obama had campaigned, President Obama had campaigned on ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And if you recall, that they lost, you know, not great midterms in his first term, which is par for the course for a president in his first term. And it was kind of the lame duck session at the end before losing before the Republicans are kind of taking over in Congress. And there were two things he wanted to get done. One was Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the other was the New START Treaty, which is existential. Certainly in the national security world, it's an important priority. And he had a lot of advisors telling him, you only have enough political capital to get one of those things done, and we think you should pick the nuclear thing. Luckily, he ignored them and went for both, and we got Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. Because I thought, I'm going to have to leave the Pentagon again. I can't, you know, we're going to try, and if we fail to get this repealed, I can't stay in this building. I've got to find some other way to contribute. But you know, it's the military is a large organization, and training is a critical part of this. And the certification process to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, people forget about that, seemed to take forever. And that was by design. It was to let the culture, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And when it finally was certified to be repealed, there were a lot of people who thought we'd already done it. But when I knew we were going to be able to, that this was on a good path, and no path of change like this is completely linear, it's forward, backwards, stalled, was when we did the training. The military is always focused on training, and that can be the hardest element to get done and get right. But I had to go to the first round of training. I was a deputy undersecretary of the Navy and had senior uniformed people working for me. And so that put me in this batch of the first people getting trained. And it was really so simple and beautiful, and you saw light bulbs go off quickly, because someone would say, can two gays go to the Marine Corps birthday ball together? And the trainer would say, can two Marines go to the birthday ball together? Would take the qualifier out of every question and ask it back. And it was the fastest training session really that I'd ever seen, because I think people got pretty quickly what the future was and what we were going to deal with. But it certainly made me more sensitive to barriers. And really trying to dig into barriers. Is this really a requirement for the job, or is it an artificial barrier that is either put there by design, for historical reasons, by accident, unintentionally, what have you? But to really ask the question, why is that the requirement? The place that was most interesting for me, because during the Obama administration, we dealt with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We dealt with, we certainly didn't finish transgender military service in the Army. And now in the Navy and the Air Force, religious accommodations for Sikhs and Muslims, and of course, opening up all positions to women in combat. When the Army prepared for that, they created this incredibly long set of requirements for every job. But it was literally, instead of you need to be able to do 10 push-ups in 15 seconds, it was you need to lift so many pounds, so many inches, because that actually was how much something weighed that we had in our inventory and how big the lift gate was and whatever vehicle it needs to go into. So we were really trying to get more specific about what's the requirement for a certain job. And then if you meet the requirement, that's all that's important.
There are so many things there we could dive into in so much greater detail, but there's one I want to touch on and pull out there, which is a common aspect of leadership, which is leading through change. And you have seen and been through so many major changes in all the organizations that you've been part of. And one of the biggest things that is a barrier to that change is often fear. And in the case of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and so many of these other changes, these fears that were out there of what the day after would be like were so overblown as to what the reality actually ended up being. How do you go about addressing those fears as a leader and driving through that change anyways, regardless of what fear might be out there?
Well, it's a good question. You know, in sort of change management research or whatever, often it starts with the individual thinking, how does this impact me? So you start with in a very local way and you broaden from there as you're communicating and explaining. And then you actually, you get local again towards the end. You know, what we realized quickly or not quickly, but over the course of this, first of all, that we're not really changing policy to allow something to happen that's not happening. We're working to have policy catch up with reality. That there, none of these things that I mentioned weren't already happening as we started debating in Washington whether they should be able to happen or not. Women in combat, gays in the military, you know, even, you know, I think a more personal way to answer your question really is the transgender military service thing. What we did, what Sparta did, what the precursors of Sparta and Sparta did was set up a bunch of lunches. In my case, this happened long enough that it started when I was in the Air Force job and moved with me to the Army job, where the secretary and the chief would have lunch with people, transgender service members in the uniform of whatever that service was. And it just made it personal all of a sudden. It was very, you know, generals, and I saw this in Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Marines are typically the ones that like the status quo the most. But when and fought the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, probably the hardest in some ways. But when the repeal happened, the Marines were the first up with a video, the commandant and the senior enlisted saying anyone in the uniform Marine is a Marine, full stop. And that's when I realized that, you know, when we did these lunches, particularly for the people who wore uniform, the chief of staff of the Air Force saw an airman. That's the first thing they saw. Same when it happened in the Army with me. And in fact, behind scenes, it changes the debate very quickly. It's still complex and there are lots of issues to work through when you make a change like that. But all of a sudden it made it about, wait a minute, these people are wearing the uniform of the service I'm in charge of. I'm responsible for them. And so that's one way to take away the fear is to tell those stories. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, the question of gay military service probably goes right to the end of the Vietnam War. 20 years that led us to this awful compromise, 20 years to get out of it, roughly 4 decades of personalizing this and telling stories and people realizing it's already happening. Transgender military service a little bit faster in that regard, but we tried to accelerate some of that, making it personal, putting faces against it. But the culminating effect of doing this and going through, you know, what's next, what's next, what's next, what's next. There's always, you know, you get in the door and there's always somebody behind you in line trying to get in as well, just sort of starts to chip away at that barrier. And what's interesting to me is one of the charges that we get is that we're experimenting with identity politics, or we're engaging in identity politics. And it was actually the Secretary of the Navy who said this, and I've stolen it from him, that we're doing the opposite. We are chipping away at these barriers, that these designations that really have nothing with your ability to do the job and just getting down to the job. So it may seem, because the reason it seems like identity politics is because we're going to move through every group that is being kept from participating for reasons that have nothing to do with their ability to do the job. And then you get to the end of this, and it's just about any American who wants to put up his or her hand to serve. So it's the same with the charge of cultural politics. And that really comes, I think, from, you know, there is a gravitational center to the culture of this country. And all you're saying is, but that's not all of the country. And so you're not I don't think that you're necessarily changing. You're just expanding how you define it and who you include.
Eric, you mentioned earlier that period of time where you didn't see anyone else like yourself and the limitations that that implied for you. And as much as your math might have been wrong about how many might have been in the building, the impact that that has on people is very, very real. And it still does today. How have you come to understand the importance of visibility and people seeing certain individuals in leadership positions? And how do you advocate for more of that and making sure that that visibility has the ability to counteract those effects?
Well, I think it makes you realize, first of all, we have a way in this country these days of politicizing every word that we use, and that DEI is going through that right now. We can unpack that a little bit. But I think what you're talking about, the diversity part's almost the easiest. Succeeding at that requires that inclusion work. And that is a number of different things at all different levels. And it makes you realize, you know, that individuals make a difference, that one of the ways you attract people and making sure that you're availing yourself of the full pool of talent of your you know, your region, your country, your state, whatever it is they have got to see a community in which they see themselves, first of all. And I think that's particularly true for younger and younger generations who are exposed to more just through social media and television and what have you. They're not going to be very interested in an organization that doesn't look much like them, first of all, if they walk in the door and they don't see that diversity that they expect and that they're used to. But diversity is so many different things. But one of them also has to be to see there's a path for me to succeed here. And if there's nobody else like me that has, it tells me that there's something wrong with that path or something wrong with the culture or the organization. So I think it makes a big difference. And I didn't think about that at whatever point I became that or got to that level in my career. I was more thinking about how I was losing control over how I came out. Because for the first time I was nominated for a Senate-confirmed job, the number two in the Air Force, the headline was gay man. I mean, my name didn't show up till like paragraph number three in the article, you know, and then the Army job, it was kind of the same, you know, first gay man or what have you. And I think my name rose to the first paragraph probably by that time. But I remember thinking, well, here I go. The whole, I wasn't closeted per se, but as you know, gay people don't have a coming out moment. Those moments are afforded to you frequently and for the rest of your life. And it's particularly, you know, in the military, it's interesting. There's these studies on the first question, you know, who are your people? Who's your family? What's your church? And, in the military, as a man, I was constantly asked, do you have a wife? That seems to have evolved a little bit to, are you married perhaps? But younger, my career, even in the Navy job, do you have a wife? Do you have a wife? Do you have a wife? And it's like, all right, I just want to get home. Do I really want to engage in this conversation and answer in a different way? But what I learned pretty quickly is, all right, I don't have to worry about that anymore because everyone in my world now knows. That's been sort of that having to deal with that's been taken out of the equation a little bit. But that's when people would come up to me and say, okay, now I see. Somebody like me can succeed in this institution, on this path, or what have you. And you mentioned earlier about being asked about coming out. The other thing I learned is how much, you know, I think we make these decisions based on fear, perhaps, of the reaction of one side of the spectrum. And what I learned having some visibility is that side of the spectrum is actually pretty small. You know, you've got, there's 100 people in a room. You've got some that know, you've got some that, you know, will support you. No questions asked. You've got some who will, might take them a moment, but they're going to be like, I want to support this person. There's this enormous community of people that are just looking for someone to latch onto, to show they're supportive. And that I was able to tap into that. It was kind of crazy to me. And then, you know, you've got a group of people that are like, I don't know that I like this, but I don't really care. And then you got the two Muppets, you know, you get down to the two ornery Muppets in the balcony and like, who cares? They're going to die soon anyhow. But I think I saw this when I had my welcoming ceremony for the Undersecretary of the Air Force job. I noticed that there was a 4-star standing against the wall. And I thought, uh-oh, some protocol person's in trouble because there was no empty seat up front. And what happened is that was the number two general. The number one general's wife had come. She had an RSVP, and she just leaned in afterwards and said, I came because I wanted you to know that I support you. And I'm glad the Air Force got you because I think it'll send a great message to the younger generation about which service might be the most welcoming. But that's really what's, for me, been interesting as I've lost control in some ways of that narrative is all this support that I was able to tap into that I wouldn't have known was there otherwise.
You bring up a topic that we speak about a lot, which is the skill set that is often developed, whether during the period of time before you're out or even once you're out, and of course coming out over and over again, of scanning the environment, reading the room, right? Building that perceptive ability to read all of those different groups of people, of potential allies and non-allies that you just mentioned. How has developing that skill in your journey as a gay man been relevant in other ways as a leader?
Well, I think it's, so that's a great question. And I still do that now, actually. I mean, you know, I remember once when I was the acting secretary of the Air Force, I went to the White House for something, you know, the annual senior military leader dinner. And I had a friend with me, a female friend, and an army general said, "Your wife is beautiful." And I'm like, "All right, remember Eric, that the whole world isn't watching you. You know, might be a big bubble that you're in, but it's still a bubble." But I still sort of scan the room. And, you know, what I look for is the same thing I try to offer other people. And when somebody says, is offering up something about themselves that they might feel is different, I just try to latch onto that and pull forward on it a little bit. So when I say my husband, the reaction matters. It doesn't mean that I take offense if there's no reaction, but sort of, I think an intuitive person will say, okay, let me send a signal here, that I care about that. And there's a lot of different ways to do that, but you just want to be inclusive. And, you know, there's research on this. It's as simple then learning things about people, asking them questions, you know, how was the weekend? What did you do? Like bringing them into these types of conversations to be inclusive, because that's what I looked for in sizing up a room. I get asked all that. I still get asked, but certainly when I was in, you know, did you encounter homophobia? And I'm like, well, this is a very hierarchical organization. They're not going to do it to my face. If I went online and read the message boards, then maybe I would see it, but I tried to stay away from those. But you just, you know, one by one, you try to bring people in and you just try to keep setting, you know, trying to be a role model if you can. I mean, that's what I tell my senior team all the time. I want you to be role models. I want you to think that way for the younger team. There was a reporter who told me once he had met with some Air Force officer who said, I'm going to brief the gay guy. Now I was the acting secretary of the Air Force at the time, so maybe that wasn't the right thing for him to have said, but this reporter saw him later and said, "How'd it go?" And he's like, "Secretary Fanning knows what he's talking about." So you can change hearts and minds pretty quickly. And it can be tiring. We know that, when you are fortunate enough to walk through a door early, your job is to help explain. And I think, maybe I'm old fashioned, to create some room for people who want to engage and want to learn. And so it's not just about safe space for the people that have been marginalized that you're trying to include. It's about safe space for the people who want to learn and change how they think about things.
In that, you touched on, again, a number of different things that I think are valuable to expand on. You spoke about losing control over how you came out, losing the narrative, realizing that the whole world maybe isn't watching all the time. And a lot of these things are pieces of perception and some of the things that come with higher level leadership roles, the pomp and circumstance. In fact, getting a parade when you are the Secretary of the Army. How, through all of that and all the work you've done to, you know yourself and to lead, do you keep yourself yourself? How do you keep a sense of humility that is so important to leadership through all of those disparate experiences?
Well, my husband certainly helps with that, keeping me humble. But I think, I've been very lucky to have very good people around me. In fact, the team I worked on in my first job in the House Armed Services Committee were still about as close as you could possibly be. In fact, it was a six-person team. One of those six was the Secretary of the Air Force when I was the Undersecretary of the Air Force and the Secretary of the Army. And we work to keep each other humble on these things. And since I kind of grew up, you know, a lot of people come into senior government positions from the outside. I just took each step on a very long ladder. And so I was able to see a lot of senior leaders over time in that building. So I had a lot of cautionary tales of the opposite of role models, you know, behavior not to mimic as I got more senior. But in terms of, you know, I think part of your question being that first, I always tried to go back to that don't ask, don't tell training thing. Even when I left the Pentagon for the last time as a Secretary of the Army, Ben was with me and they had an honor guard going down the stairs. And before the ceremonial doors opened to the Pentagon, Ben's like, "What should we do?" And for a moment, I'm like, "I don't know." And I'm like, "Well, what does any other couple do that leaves the building? You know, we're gonna walk down together. You're not gonna walk behind me or something like that." So, some of those things never end, but you get some muscle memory to work through them a little bit faster. I mean, you know, again, at the start of this, I said about still benefiting from privilege, because the one diversity aspect for me, I could hide. at the end of the Obama administration, President Obama said, look, gay, cisgender white men have done okay in this administration. You guys now, your job is to help other people. No more help for you, which is a sign of success. And in fact, in my bios now, unless it's for something like this, when someone's introducing me, the gay thing doesn't even come up anymore. Which in many ways is nice. I feel honored to have been able to play whatever role I played in this. That's been a valuable opportunity, a treasured opportunity for me, but it is also nice to think that we've made enough progress that some of these things are going away. I mean, it's getting harder and harder and harder to be called the first these days. It really takes somebody who's a pretty interesting and special person, because we've broken through some barriers. And, like I said, it's never linear. We can't give up on progress, but we can celebrate the progress too.
How do you approach that sort of paradoxical thing that on the one hand, it's great that it doesn't come up. It shouldn't have to come up. You spent a lot of your career focusing on not trying to highlight the distinctions, but rather remove the barriers that prevent people as these false criteria from serving or doing whatever role they might want to do as a result of that. So there's that side of the equation that's, it shouldn't be important. It shouldn't matter. It certainly shouldn't prevent them from working in a way that they want to work, contributing. But at the same time, the importance of visibility, the importance of inclusivity, the way in which you are able to open doors for others by actually emphasizing that. And I know that you actually said in 2016, just before you were confirmed, that there was a period of time where you thought it shouldn't come up and you had started coming to embrace that there actually was value in putting a spotlight on your identity in that way because of how it can help others.
I remember very early on in my career, right after I'd come out, my then brother-in-law asking a lot of well-meaning questions because he was just curious and trying to learn. He's like, well, why do you put rainbow stickers on your car? And I'm like, well, I don't have one in my car. But partly because in the absence of some signal, people will assume that you're part of the mainstream. And so it is important that we remind people when we can that diversity already exists. And I think there's a generational thing here too. When we did religious accommodations for Sikhs and Muslims, which has to do with beards and turbans largely, but lots of other things too, and leads to lots of other issues. In some ways, it was more emotional than all the other things we worked on because, think of the word uniformity, and we are allowing something that starts to in the mind of those who are concerned chip away at that uniformity. But I remember a very emotional meeting with senior generals about this back in my office, and I asked my colonel who'd just come out of major command, my military assistant, and he said, I can make it work. And the next week we were down in South Carolina, Fort Jackson, where a lot of the basic training takes place in the Army. And I asked this young lieutenant who looked at me like I had three heads. And he pointed, I was like 10 feet away. There's an 18-year-old basic training wearing a turban. And the lieutenant's like, well, we are figuring it out with no help from you up there, which is a part of why we changed some of these policies. It's like, we got to help these young officers and enlisted in the field who are dealing with the reality that we're thinking is notional. But it made me realize too, back to what we were talking about earlier, that there's a generational thing. That young people today, that they're going to be suspicious of some place that doesn't reflect the wealth of diversity of the country that they've grown in, up in, that they've watched on TV. But they don't know about that. If it's not something, a friend of mine earlier in my life said, I wish gay people were purple. So everybody would know who we are. If there isn't some visible manifestation to show, then we have to find ways to counteract assumptions that people make. And I think that gravitational assumption pull is generally, if I don't see anything, then you're like that center part of the culture as we define ourselves.
I want to go back to a little bit about your confirmation, because I think there's an interesting note in there. Throughout this interview, you've talked a lot about, the value it brings when someone can simply do their job if they can meet the standards of their job. The identity stuff, we just need to remove the barriers so that they can do their job when they're qualified for it. And during your conversation, Senator McCain said, even though it ended up being an unrelated issue, that, you know, what we're doing here is we're telling a nominee who's totally qualified, that the person cannot fulfill those responsibilities and take on this leadership post because of an unrelated issue. And it seemed like, you know, you get through it and it's almost a nothing burger on those issues, and you get into the job. And we saw that with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We saw that with the transgender inclusion. But now we're starting to go maybe in a different direction. And it may be more than fear that is driving us to think about these things as problematic. How do we bring the conversation and the culture back to that point where it is about your capability to do the job, and we don't need to worry about all these things that are being attacked over identity?
Well, so the divisiveness right now in the country is not at an all-time high. I was a history major, so, you know, history is, it repeats itself and is cyclical, and we've had a civil war, and the 60s were pretty bad. But right now is pretty bad, and everything gets caught up in it. It's very hard to have a nuanced conversation about things where people can challenge their own assumptions, challenge other people's assumptions, sharpen their argument, their viewpoint, or change their argument or their viewpoint. So it's kind of, you know, my first boss had this expression, you know, when tempers flare or personalities flare or things get divisive, focus on the do, focus on the work. And so I try to take this back to the benefits of why we do this. You know, you can have all the societal arguments you want and what's the right thing to do and what's not. But for example, in the private sector, where I'm based now, this is an important aspect of competition. Company A wants to beat Company B. And the way that Company A wants to do that is build the best team that it can. And they know that, first of all, science is pretty clear cut on this at this point, that a diverse team and diversity in a broad way on a common problem set comes up with the best, most creative solutions. It's also a sign that you're not leaving potential talent on the table. If your workforce looks like the pool that from which you're drawing, then you're thinking, all right, I am being creative and I'm doing the hard work to make sure that I'm recruiting, so I'm getting the big part of my funnel is as big as possible. So what comes out the other end is as big, as good and strong as possible. So I focus on that part of it. That's why we do these things. I think, you know, in terms of the politics today, the equity part is really where a lot of this, the divisiveness or the politics is based, opportunity versus outcome. But the diversity part is strong. It's just, it's hard because when you are the first, it's easy to become a token. Eric Fanning only got that job because he's gay. I didn't worry about that inside the building because by the time I became the Secretary of the Army, I had been Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, Undersecretary of the Air Force, Acting Secretary, Chief of Staff to Ash Carter, Acting Undersecretary of the Army, Acting Secretary of the Army for a while before I was confirmed. So people knew me and I knew them. And inside the building, we were just focusing on what we needed to do. But it can be hard for those first people who are tokens, which is why when you're building a diverse team, you also have to do the hard work. I do not like this false choice that some people present that you're either building a diverse team or you're building the best team. The best team is both of those things. but that means you've got to do the hard work to find the right person for the right job and build the team that you need. So, you're not just hiring one person after another. You are building a team. President Obama sent slates of candidates back if they weren't diverse for a number of reasons. But what he would often say is, this looks like a lazy search to me. If everyone on the slate looks like the person who created the slate, I don't have a lot of confidence that you did the hard work to find the best people for this job. And I encountered that too. I used to think, Secretary of the Army is three people come to me for a military assistant or something. They've made it through all the traps and I just need to pick the one that I think will gel with me the best. Well, that's not good for diversity right from the jump, to approach a slate that way. But then I started looking at the slates more and realizing, you know what, how do I know they've made it through all the traps? How do I know how this is put together? How do I know the full breadth of the Army has been considered for a job in the secretary's office, which often leads to another good job afterwards. So it's a never ending process with a lot of work. But I think to go back to your question, it is focusing on the do, focusing on the real immediate outcomes that you come up to. I mean, if it's a tense situation, maybe not engage on the social parts of that question, but just say, hey, my job is to build the best team possible because I got to beat that guy.
In terms of the idea that the best team and the most diverse team can be the same thing, there's even research that shows that's the case in terms of team effectiveness. A homogeneous team will have efficient results and a diverse team will have effective results. And yet, as you mentioned, it takes a lot more work, right, to make that team cohesive, to overcome some of those tensions and frictions that may exist. And you've done that work in a wide variety of different organizations, industry sectors. What is it that you've seen, particularly perhaps more recently, what is the nature of that hard work now? What are those types of challenges? And what would you share with other leaders who are trying to overcome those challenges and get the best out of diverse and inclusive teams that are leveraging that diversity of thought for team effectiveness?
Points on the board for the team. So back to that concept of focusing on the do. You want to get that team focused on whatever it is you need them to do and drive towards success and celebrate that success. That, you know, and a part of that too is, you know, a team is never finished or complete. I notice leaders all the time who pull punches with difficult teammates, difficult colleagues, and you fall into the trap of thinking that's just one person. I'm not going to deal with it. The actively disengaged members of a team have a disproportionate impact on the team, and the team needs to see accountability. The team needs to see that you're constantly taking care of the good performers on the team by finding them other good performers. And so get the team focused on the job, celebrate the successes, and make sure when there's a problem on the team that you deal with it. You deal with it quickly and you deal with it directly. And if you need to make a change, you make a change.
On any good team, any good organization, there's going to be setbacks. There are going to be challenges that you encounter. And for someone of a marginalized identity, they may think, well, it's because of who I am, or the team may even blame a person for some of that. How do you support those developing leaders that come from those marginalized backgrounds to make sure that they have that chance to further develop? Or when you're picking those slates, as has often been said, you know, how do you avoid that ducks pick ducks and we make sure we keep developing future leaders through times of challenge?
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting, if you take your eye off of this work, it does revert back. You know, a slate or a roster of speakers at a conference or something. It's amazing to me how if we don't think about this intentionally for a while, I look at the list. I'm like, oh my God, how'd this happen? There are a number of ways that I try to do that. I try to make sure nobody feels like they're the only one in the organization. And AIA is only 50, 55 people. So there's only so much I can do there, but I want to make sure no one feels like they're the only person in the organization, so they have someplace to go. I try to make sure that the senior team has somebody who seems that anybody on the team maybe can relate to, so they have someone they can go talk to if there's an issue like that, if someone's not performing. We try very hard to give people tools and developments. I always assume if there's a miscommunication or a misfire on something, that the first round is on me, that I didn't communicate well or focus well enough. And if it's a team and we have a meeting, I always try to start by, this is what I'm going to do differently next time. What is everyone else going to do differently next time? Sometimes none of that works and you have to make a change because ultimately, you know, a team comes together for some reason. And in the case of an association like mine, we have members paying us to do things. And so we need to get those things done. But a big part of it for me is making sure, I tell my senior team leads that they don't just have responsibility for their team. That's primarily what they're, but they're responsible for everybody else too. And they need that collectively, hopefully there's somebody there, if not me, that anybody can go to. If they have an issue to talk about, and that can be hard work. I have a new HR director for that reason. I wanted somebody who I thought had more of a welcoming, open door aspect to that. And then I try to set up informal interactions. I manage by walking the floor. I loop that floor all day long. But we do, you know, lunches where the first four, five, six people who say yes get to come, and I do them in cadres. So other than me, because I guess I'm everybody's boss as the CEO, nobody, they're not, none of their other direct supervisors are in the room. Because that's another thing that I think research is pretty compelling on, that the majority, if not the vast majority, of someone's sense of engagement at work is tied to the relationship with the direct supervisor. So I try to punch through that a little bit with some regularity. And we survey to look for problems regularly. We especially did that during COVID. So using a lot of tools just to see if there's a problem going forward. You know, what I think you'd want to bake into your culture the assumption that if there's a problem, it's probably because that person doesn't have the tools that they need or is in an eddy they can't get out of. And so if you approach it that way, and that doesn't always mean that's the case, but it allows you to go in with a more constructive way and maybe solve the problem.
You have contributed so much to the LGBTQ community throughout your career, both in terms of your presence and visibility, your active mentoring and support, as you've just described, as well as actual policy and change that you've influenced. And you clearly continue to still do that in your current role. What do you see as next for yourself in what you would like to continue contributing to the community?
That's a good question. You know, I never kind of know what's next. When I give advice to young people, I remember at the start of the Obama administration, there's sort of three levels of political appointees: Schedule C, which is junior to high mid, then non-career senior executive service, SES. It sort of corresponds with the civil service. And then PAS, presidential appointment with Senate confirmation, the senior principal jobs. And I had been a Schedule C in the Clinton administration, come back in the Obama administration first as an SES, hiring these young people into Schedule C positions. And one of them said, I've been tasked with asking the question, how do we become SES? I'm like, well, you just literally started this week. Maybe you focus on doing the job you've got a little bit. And I went away for 12 years. And that first job in the Clinton administration or the Obama administration made a very strange career finally look like an arc. My parents didn't have any idea what I was doing. But in my 30 plus years now, there's only been one job that I specifically targeted and got. Everything else was what surfaced as I started to think about what's next, or surfaced because I tried to do the job I had really well. Right now, I like the job that I'm in. The industry is interesting. It's still a good learning curve for me, which is an important part of a job. And this team building that we've talked about, I made some big moves last year. And so I have this team that's really exciting that I feel committed to, but I don't know what's next. I served on a couple of boards in the community. I don't know that that's right for me. Example, I try to make my time available for organizations that might want to use it in some different or interesting way.
Well, the fact that you don't know what's next is really like all of us. None of us know what's next, but if we have a lot of open doors in front of us, that's incredibly valuable for any of us as individuals. And I think a lot of people are thankful to folks like you and other senior LGBT leaders who have allowed more of those doors to be open. So Eric Fanning, thank you for opening some of those doors, and thank you so much for joining us here on Forged in Fire.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The views and ideas expressed by the hosts and guests of this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the organizations or institutions they represent. Forged in Fire is a collective effort brought to you by a fantastic team of passionate individuals. This podcast is produced and engineered by Frida Castellanos, media production by Christina George, operations by Imogene Thomas, and communications by Chelsea Asplund. Brie Fram serves as executive producer and hosts the show along with Dr. Liz Cavallaro. But we couldn't do this without the inspiration provided by LGBTQ+ leaders around the world working hard to build a better future for all. For more information, visit our website at forgedinfire.org.